Like many people, my first introduction to the idea of the spiritual path came through a desire for greater physical health. I was in my late teens, and I just began to become interested in what I was putting into my body and how it affected my consciousness, and I began to read various books. This was in the very early days of what is now a worldwide movement toward healthier eating. I know my own mother, long after she had raised her children and we'd all left home, she read the book by Adele Davis, which was a very consciousness-changing book for middle America, and it basically told my mother that she'd poisoned us all through our childhood, hoping to raise us well. And she, with heartfelt, you know, feeling, apologized for having fed us so many canned vegetables and Velveeta cheese and white sugar. And I remember my favorite sandwich being a folded piece of Wonder Bread with margarine and white sugar on it. You know, it's like it would be like being sent to hell and being fed the worst meal you can imagine now. My other friend talked about how she used to sit on the porch and drink a glass of Kool-Aid and eat Velveeta cheese. And that's just what made her the happiest. I mean, it's a wonder we grew up at all, actually. But, you know, in the late 60s when my generation started, you know, this what's become a mainstream revolution, I remember a friend of mine who'd actually worked for General Mills explaining that there was more nutrition in the box that the Cheerios came in than there was in the Cheerios. And this was like so outside of things. And many, many years later, I was in seclusion at Ananda retreat. And when you're in seclusion, you know, really cut off from all stimulus, everything looms rather large. And I was receiving my meals on a tray from the kitchen at the retreat, but then the kitchen closed for a few days and I was still out there, so they just sent me some groceries to take care of myself. And one of the things they sent me was a box. It was actually a General Mills box of cereal, but now 30 years later the whole point is whole grain. So General Mills is telling me about all the nutrition in this cereal, and they had taken a flake on the cover and then they'd blown it up, you know, 1,000 times so that you could actually see the whole grain, you know, in the box there. And I don't know, for some reason that struck me as the funniest thing. Every time I looked at General Mills trying to tell me how healthy they were and showing me their whole grain in this mammoth form, it just, you know, revolutions are not started by individuals or by governments. You know, it doesn't come from the top down. A real change in society comes because many, many individuals at a grassroots level become persuaded that something is true and they simply begin to act upon it. When we became vegetarians, when we started eating whole grains, when we started making our own bread and all the sorts of things that you can now get from Raley's and Safeway and so on like that, I mean, one of my relatives sent my diet to a doctor because she was afraid I was going to die, you know, eating what I was eating. He pronounced it the healthiest diet he'd ever heard of, which did a lot to ease her suffering, but didn't make the dinner table any more comfortable among us, you know. Have a little roast beef, honey, how can it hurt you? You know, like that. Like that wonderful scene in my Big Fat Greek Wedding, some of you have seen it, where the man protests that he's a vegetarian, and the Greek woman is so confused, she said, "I'll cook lamb." I just didn't know where to go with it. Okay, no beef. Okay, then lamb. You know, honey, it's still a dead animal. I mean, it's all the same. I'm not going to eat it. But that's all not exactly where I'm talking about going today. But what we are talking about today is the question that consciousness, the change of consciousness, cannot be forced. It can't be forced by government. It can't be forced by your relatives. It can't be forced by the person closest to you. It can't and will not be forced by God and Guru. It will only and can only arise spontaneously from our actual perception of where our happiness is going to come from. Now, this is both the good news and the bad news. The good news about this is, don't worry, nobody's going to take your free will away from you. Nobody's going to hypnotize you. No cult is going to sort of grab you and make you into something you're not going to want to be. You may want to be a mindless cult member for a while, but sooner or later that'll stop working. And certainly you're not going to find it on any true path, because all of us only ever do that which we think will bring us happiness, no matter how incredibly stupid that concept might be. At the time, it seemed like a good idea. Every murderer, every rapist, every drug addict, you know, every mean, horrible, selfish person who ends up alone, somewhere along the way, it seemed like a good idea. And Swamiji, in one of his writings recently, was that I was recently studying, he said, it's just a simple fact. Sooner or later, you will be drawn to God. He said, not because anyone will make you do that, except that nothing else will satisfy your heart. And you have to, of course, think in terms of more than one lifetime, because you look at one incarnation and people say, well, I'm perfectly happy. It's all working very well for me. And it may be working very well for that person, because in fact, and this is an interesting fact about life that's worth remembering, we learn a certain amount from having our desires frustrated. We learn a certain amount from not getting what we want. But most of the time, when we don't get what we want, the desire just goes underground and becomes more intensified. And sooner or later, if not in this lifetime, then another one, we're going to taste that fruit. Because as long as we believe it's going to satisfy our hunger, we're going to try to get a bite of it. And it's only when we've been able to experience whatever that particular cup has to offer down to the last drop and know from our own experience whether or not it fills that final deep, silent sometimes, or sometimes desperately screaming, but deep inner longing for a kind of perfect happiness that is, we know, ours by right. And so in a sense, the Gita puts it this way too, in a very interesting way, by saying it like this: you can only progress according to your own nature. And there's no point in trying to suppress realities that are yours in the hope that you're not ever going to have to deal with them. Whatever your own nature is, we're just going to have to work our way through it and gradually come to the freedom that we're looking for. But balanced against that, we have this chant that Brenda was leading us in this morning. I have nothing, I am free. I own no one, I am free. I need nothing, I am free. I need no one, I am free. I've had many, many emails over the years, well, even before there was email, like, why do we sing such a terrible chant? What about my wife? What about my children? I need no one, I am free. What about my home? I need nothing, I am free. I want no one, I am free. It sounds just awful to some people. And others of us, I must confess, love singing, and I need nothing, I am free. You know, David and I, 28 years of, relatively speaking, very happy marriage, sit next to each other and sing, I need no one, I am free. You know, it's kind of a confusing message on a certain level, isn't it? So we have to look deeper. We have to really understand what a complex seeming reality we're living in. But above all, we have to look very, very deep into our own hearts. I have a nephew who's now about 20, maybe he'll be almost 21 this year. Very fine man, deep thinker, you know, on his way, just living his life out according to the generation into which he was born. And from time to time when he visits with me, we have philosophical discussions. And he shows me his world, and I try to show him mine. And we try to be respectful and interested in each other's worlds. And at one point, he wanted me to watch some movie that he thought was good. He hadn't seen it, to give him some credit, some slight credit in this. And so we sat down and watched it together. It was, it wasn't even pornographic. It wasn't even, didn't even rise to the level of pornography. It was just gross. It just, everything about it was gross. And I watched it for maybe 5 or 6 minutes. And finally I turned to him and I said, you know, I do my best to be broad-minded, and I don't want to become, you know, your old curmudgeonly aunt, you know, like this. But we must turn off this movie. Not only can I not watch it, I cannot be in any household in which this movie is shown, you know. And it was because what it did is it denigrated everything fine and refined about life. It just reduced life down to the grossest sort of physical functions, the most egoic attitudes. It just took everything and said, let us find the grossest possible way to manifest this, and then we'll do that. And he's just a young man, you know, he's just watching it. And after that, I felt like, you know, if you reject a person's reality too completely, then you lose contact with them. And it's the biggest danger between the generations, because really weird things happen from one generation to the next. I mean, unfortunately, I have a very vivid memory of important aspects of my upbringing. And I can very clearly see myself and my father and myself and my mother when I was 17, 18, 19, 20, and the exchanges that we had. And so all of a sudden, I was standing in one of those relationships, except I was the old person and he was the young person. I didn't like that feeling. So I tried to think, what possible positive thing can I say? So I sat with him and I said, you know, you have grown up in a world that is so coarse in so many ways, in which refinement has been removed in so many ways that you don't even know it. You don't even have any idea how offensive to your soul so many of the things are that you take for granted. But here's the good news. Whatever values you end up with are going to be entirely self-discovered, because nothing is helping you. Absolutely nothing. The entire world is telling you, be selfish, be sexual, be concerned about yourself, don't have loyalties, just, you know, everything. I can go on and on and on, and it's partly because of the all-pervasive divorce, the lack of roots, the lack of multi-generations. As one of my friends put it, she sort of felt like her 30-year-old boss did not form relationships with anyone. He just made alliances, mutually beneficial alliances. And it was understood that these are mutually beneficial, and as soon as they cease to be mutually beneficial, then we'll all just go our own way. Isn't that an interesting way to put it? And that is, to a large extent, I think, the product of divorce. Because we're together as long as it's mutually beneficial to us, and then we go our own ways. And that, you know, and everybody nods as if it were sensible. It's not that it's as simple as that, but you see how these values get started, especially in terms of sexuality and sensuality. And the world just tells you, I mean, the worship of sex is going to be such an embarrassment in the future. People are just, as Swami said, people are going to look back at this age and all they're going to say is, the so-called art of this age, all they're going to say is, boy, did those people have problems. Wow, you know? Because all it is, you know, just this stuff. You know, like as if this was really what was going to make us happy. You know? I mean, if you're just looking at it, where is the beauty in this? You know, what does that say to your soul? It doesn't say anything. It just says move, 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 move. Whereas what really satisfies us is this deep inner longing. But that natural hunger for the subtle pleasure of divinity is not being fed. And when we ignore a natural hunger, it gradually goes to sleep, at least temporarily. Back in those early days when I was first starting out, learning how to be healthy, I remember reading this book. It was a book about the necessity to drink water. And it described in such a vividly disgusting manner what happens to your body when you don't drink enough water, that virtually every day since then, I have drunk enough water. Because otherwise these pictures start growing in my mind of what's happening to my dehydrated interior, you know, without enough water to clean house every day. But it also said something very interesting, because it told you, you know, you have to drink 8 glasses of water or whatever it is. And it said, but the problem is you're not thirsty for that water, because having suppressed our natural thirst for so many years, we just no longer feel it. Or what we feel, we no longer identify as being thirsty. So it said, you know, put your 8 glasses of water out on the counter and drink them every day, no matter whether you're thirsty or not. And gradually you will reawaken your natural thirst. That's how he put it. So I dutifully did that and can honestly say now that that's, of course, what happened. Well, what's happened in being material beings, and what to speak of living in an age like the one we're living in, our natural hunger for the refined things of the divine is not fed. And in fact, many grosser appetites are constantly stimulated. The desire for material things, the desire to feel inadequate unless I have so-and-so. Somebody amusingly said to me once, you go to one of these high fashion malls, or you go even just to the Stanford Mall where there's so many beautiful clothes, and you see all the women and the men shopping for all these beautiful things, and yet almost none of them look genuinely attractive. None of the people shopping, you know, but they're all buying the same things. You know, it's sort of like there's this imaginary idea of what I can really get, but that very anxiety to create that satisfaction and beauty by adding something to me in itself takes away the natural beauty that's in us. And on the other side of it, the more deeply we feed our natural thirst for divine things, the more the inner plant begins to swell and to shine. Now, this leads to a certain discipline in our life. This leads to a certain realization that I must meditate. I must meditate every day. I must dip, at least make an effort to dip into this ocean of spirit. I must discipline, at least to whatever extent I'm capable of, my desire to do those things which destroy my physical health. I must make an effort to have right attitude, to have faith in God, because we begin to become thirsty for those attitudes. It's very confusing sometimes when we read about the lives of saints, or if you see a well-done movie. I know the movie about Saint Bernadette of Lourdes. There's an old black and white movie. I don't think anything that's been done in probably the last 40 years is worth watching, because even the stories of saints now are very modernized. I saw this, somebody gave me a film that was made in Italy of St. Francis and St. Clare. Beautiful, you know, the story of Francis and Clare is exquisitely beautiful. And the director cast a 17-year-old woman as Clare, because that was about how old Clare actually was when she turned her back on her family and went off to live with Francis. She was a very beautiful woman. Unfortunately, she was very conscious of the fact that she was a very beautiful woman, and so was the director. So a great many of the scenes were just Claire. You know, and the camera would focus in on her sort of violet blue eyes, and then she would drop her black lashes piously over this way. You know. And afterwards, they did a little interviewer and asked her, how did it feel to play St. Clare? I really like saying St. Clare. Clare was a woman who knew what she wanted and went after what she wanted. Well, sort of. You know, she did leave everything to follow Francis, but I think you're unclear on the concept here. You know? But in the movie of Bernadette, which is exactly the opposite, I think it's called St. Bernadette of Lourdes. Song of Bernadette, thank you, Helen. I knew you would know. Our dear Irish Catholic friends always keep us up to date on all the saints. Song of Bernadette. But at the end of her life, many of you may not know this if you weren't raised Catholic. Bernadette was an uneducated young girl in France, and what she had called a beautiful lady appeared to her. Everyone else decided it had to have been Mother Mary, Jesus's Mother Mary. But Bernadette only ever called her the beautiful lady. And a miraculous spring appeared there, and that spring had healing powers. And there's a huge, huge, huge complex in Lourdes, France now, where people go to bathe in the water because of all the miracles that are done. And it all began from this little shepherd girl. And she didn't live very long. She went into a convent and then died when she was quite young. And toward the end of her life, she was so, at least the way they portray it, she was so distressed by certain things that she had done in her life. And even for the sake of drama in the story, you know, she was so distressed because of the time her mother had worked so hard to make this special soup. And Bernadette had said, I don't want any, I don't like it. So she's on her deathbed and she's lamenting the fact that she had been so unkind to her mother, who had so many pressures on her, and if only she'd been more kind to her mother. And one can't help think, gee, if that's all I had to complain about, I would feel pretty good. But what you have to understand is, the more refined our understanding becomes, the more white the sheet of our consciousness becomes, the more even one little speck begins to stand out and be something we really want hard. We want to work hard to eradicate. So in the process of our spiritual life, it's not that we say, I don't want that, I am this kind of person, I'm not like that, I am this kind of person. As Swamiji corrected me once, he said, you think that a good devotee would not feel that way, so you pretend that you don't feel that way. But you don't fool me and you don't fool God. So we can't say, oh, I don't have anger, I'm not angry. Oh, it's fine with me, I'm not attached. You can't just make statements about who you think you ought to be. We have to be very courageous about recognizing who we actually are. I was speaking to someone recently, very poignant conversation about an individual who had reason to feel badly about certain mistakes that the person had made. You know, sometimes we do really bad things. We just do, don't we? Always seem like a good idea at the time. But in retrospect, sometimes it isn't. And sometimes we have serious things that we carry. And so this person was saying he was very angry with himself for the mistakes that had been made. I said, well, it's good to a certain extent to tell yourself that the price wasn't worth it. You know, to really impress upon your subconscious mind that the price wasn't worth it. So that the next time you're tempted, you'll remember the price is not worth it. I have this strange phenomenon where I sometimes, actually less so now, but I have had dreams in which I do very adharmic things. Dharma means righteousness, and adharmic means the opposite of righteousness. I do something that's not good. And then that all the consequences of it, as dreams go, speed up, and it all starts rolling over me. And then somewhere in there I think, but this is so awful. I know better than this. Why did I do such a dumb thing? And then I'll realize, oh, I'm dreaming. I didn't actually do it. And what I sort of feel that is, like, that's the past life memory of serious transgressions and the impression that I've made on my subconscious that the price isn't worth it. So in this sense, not anger exactly, but a very strong recognition that yes, it wasn't smart and the price isn't worth it. And therefore the next time I'm in that war of temptation versus discipline, the price isn't worth it. Okay? But on the other hand, Sri Yukteswar says in Autobiography of a Yogi, the past lives of all men are dark with many shames. He even uses that word, many things that we should be ashamed of, because we ought to be ashamed of them. They were really not good things, but all of us, the past lives of all of us, and the present life of most of us, has a lot of things in it that we're not proud of. But that's just the way it is. And we cannot rescue ourselves from that fact by saying, oh, it was all just fine. It was just fine. I'm not attached. I'm not angry. We can't, because that's what's happened. The only way we can rescue ourselves is to see it from God's point of view. When Swami Kriyananda was being tormented through lawsuits and other public persecution, and he was being vilified in the most dishonest way with lies and manipulation of the legal system and horrifically dishonest newspaper reporting, it was an adventure that many of us went through in the 90s with Ananda. At one point, Swamiji was meditating, and he was having to dig deep on this. And as he expressed it to us later, he prayed to Babaji, and he said, I accept whatever you give me, but why are you letting these evil, unrighteous people have power over me? He said, I've been dharmic my whole life. Why are you giving so much power to these people? And he said he felt Babaji's presence, and Babaji said, they're all my children. Isn't that amazing? They're all my children. Do we think that evil people are not part of God? Do we think that everything was created by God? Everyone is a child of God, but not him and not her and not that one. And me, yes, but not that one. If everything is just one reality, how can something be part or not part? If God's love is unconditional, how can he withhold it from anyone? Now, it's not that God withholds our love, his love from us. It's that when we live contrary to our own nature, we suffer. If we live a whole life on Velveeta cheese and Kool-Aid, if not in this incarnation, usually in this incarnation, the body will break down. If not, we will be inexplicably, inexplicably unhealthy in future lives. If we break all the laws of good physical health, the physical body will not stand up to that. If we break the laws of divine bliss, human happiness will not stand up to that. Sooner or later, it will catch up with us. But it isn't because God withdraws his love. God watches us withdraw our own capacity to be happy from ourselves. But his love remains exactly the same. Think of the example of Jesus and Judas, adding to this what Yogananda tells us, which was Judas Iscariot, who betrayed Jesus, and Jesus knew he was going to betray him. Master said, Yogananda said, that Judas was liberated, became spiritually free in the last century, and Yogananda said, I knew him. I knew the man who had been Judas in a past life. He was a disciple of Sri Ramakrishna, had been sent to Sri Ramakrishna by Christ. And he still had a little attachment to money. And when some of the other disciples teased him a little about it, Ramakrishna, acting as his guru, said, no, leave him alone. He suffered enough for that. Now, if God can stick by Judas and bring him back around again, and why did Judas come back around? Because the price wasn't worth it. 30 pieces of silver was not enough. But more than that, betraying his own divine nature caused him so much misery that sooner or later he had to come back. And when he came back, just like the prodigal son, divine mother, his master was just waiting there. Oh, darling, I'm so glad you finally figured it out and came back. If a human mother can welcome a wandering child back, think how powerful the divine love is for us. It's the only way to escape. Even if we're very angry and ashamed of all the things that we've done, it really doesn't matter what we think, because Divine Mother's just waiting for us to suffer enough to turn around and say back, okay, now you guide me. Our hearts were made for thee alone. And we will be restless until we find our rest in thee.